4, Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says the United States does intend to negotiate the peace plan discussed between U.S. President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, despite a statement from North Korea's foreign ministry saying that discussions with Pompeo were regrettable. Pompeo says he had many hours of productive conversations with North Korean officials in his latest endeavor.
These are complicated issues, but we made progress on almost all of the central issues. Some places a great deal of progress, other places there's still more work to be done.
North Korea's foreign ministry accused Washington of attempting to unilaterally force Pyongyang to scrap its nuclear weapons program. China says it was forced to take a necessary counterattack and responded in kind to the U.S. after Washington placed tariffs on 800 Chinese import products valued at $34 billion. Meantime, economic analysts say the effects of President Trump's growing trade disputes are already being felt. AP's Ben Thomas has more.
Mark Hamrick at Bankrate.com says the negative impact of the president's trade disputes has been slight so far, but damage is already being done to the U.S. economy. Most importantly, a decline in business confidence.
The certainty that business leaders can have trying to anticipate the environment over the next 6 to 12 months.
Hamrick says while President Trump sees it as part of a broader strategy, forcing trade partners to the bargaining table, many observers are hoping he surprises everyone.
In the sense of broader, more positive trading agreements around the world, but so far that has yet to happen.
Ben Thomas, Washington.
And more than 15 people have been killed, more than 24 others wounded in 2 assaults a Saturday on the compound of Somalia's Interior and Security Ministries in the capital city, Mogadishu. This is VOA News. The soccer coach of 12 boys trapped in a water-filled cave in Thailand wrote an apology to the children's parents. He promised to take the very best care of them while rescuers attempt to find a means of getting to them and providing oxygen to them. Officials there say there's limited amounts of time since they've got a flooded region and the weather is worsening. The regional governor says he's told the parents of the 12 boys that rescuers want to minimize the risk of an evacuation, but they can't wait too long with the season of monsoon rains.
I talk to them every day. If they would like me to bring their kids out, I said that it had to be minimum leaks. But if it's not enough leaks for us, we try to wait. But we cannot wait until the rain.
Authorities have been racing to pump out water before more storms in the coming days raise the levels again. At this time, diving is the only possible method of escape, even though cave rescue experts warn it's extremely dangerous, even for those with experience. At least 49 people were killed, more than 47 still missing, in southwestern Japan, and mudslides triggered by torrential downpours. Japan's Fire and Disaster Management Agency said an additional 3.1 million residents have been advised to evacuate. The International Organization for Migration is praising Libya's dramatically stepped-up anti-smuggler operations with European Union support. It notes the number of migrants rescued in Libya's territorial waters and brought back to shore has greatly increased. VOA's Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
IOM Chief Swing recently returned from a 2-day visit to Libya, where he appealed to the authorities to end the cruel policy of locking up migrants who already have suffered so much trying to reach European shores. IOM spokesman Leonard Doyle says there are some signs the authorities are willing to consider this.
They'll probably do it by trying to speed up their repatriation. So we support them in voluntary repatriation, voluntary return, humanitarian return from Libya. Sometimes takes a while because they don't have papers, they don't have documents. The only embassies in the country really full-time are African embassies, and even they are at very low capacity.
Doyle says once the documentation and bureaucratic process is completed, it will be relatively simple to repatriate the migrants.
Lisa Schlein reporting for VOA, and the U.S. government has asked court for more time to reunite immigrant children with their parents. The families were separated when crossing the U.S.-Mexico border illegally under the Trump administration's zero-tolerance policy. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA
That's
News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
That is the blackmail. They want to blackmail this country and hold it to ransom. We are saying democratic accountability is part of the fuel that keeps the engine of a sound and fledgling democracy working.
The Sierra Leonean Anti-Corruption Commission accuses former Affairs Vice President Victor Faure of corruption.
We are confident today that change is going to come. We cannot continue to treat our own people this way, and we are determined to make sure that by hook or crook today, by democratic, will bring change.
The Ghanaian ruling New Patriotic Party, or NPP, holds its National Delegates Conference Saturday to choose new leaders.
For the first time in Malawi, we have adopted the biometric voter registration system. This will produce credible voters' roll, which is very, very important for elections.
And the Malawi Electoral Commission compiles a voter list to be used for next year's elections. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Cameroonian main opposition Social Democratic Front, or SDF, has chosen Joshua Osei as the candidate for the upcoming presidential election. He is the first Anglophone Cameroonian to serve as a parliamentarian in the commercial capital Douala. He faces long-term President Paul Biya in the anticipated October 9 presidential election. This as the country faces a crisis in the English regions. Presidential candidate Osei joins me live here in the VOA studios. Good afternoon, Josh.
Good afternoon, Peter.
How are you?
Well, I'm fine, thank you.
Good. I understand the SDF reposes great confidence in you to defeat Paul Biya in the upcoming presidential election. Why are you running in the first place, and how confident are you that you're going to defeat him?
Well, first of all, I'm very confident that we'll defeat him. And secondly, if you ask me why I'm running, I would need a bit more time than you have today, but I can give you some of the highlights. I think it's time, first of all, for generational change in Cameroon. Secondly, it's time for a new approach to how we handle policy in Cameroon. That is how the country is being managed. You know, Cameroon is one of the most corrupt countries in the world. We are in a situation today with an oligarchy in place that is unable to deliver the slightest amenities to the Cameroonian people, be they social, be they infrastructural, even certain dispensations that are obligatory, like the rule of law and peace, has gone away for the past 10 years. So it is important that we turn around. And I think in Cameroon today, the big question is no longer whether Mr. Biya must be replaced. The question is, how should it be replaced? And unfortunately, there are many people who believe that he should be replaced by the bullet, and I'm one of those who thinks he should be replaced by the bullet.
So let me ask you this question about the ongoing political and security challenges in the English regions of Cameroon. How best do you think these problems could be addressed? Because it appears that thousands have been affected, villages have been burned, the human rights groups, international community keep on putting pressure on the government to find a lasting solution. They've been calling for dialogue. It appears not to be happening. What can you do in your own capacity, if they're reposing confidence in you, to resolve these problems?
Well, I think you've given the answer in your question. The fundamental issue is that the present government is unable to give any beginning of a solution or a lasting solution. And so I make it very clear. The problem is not in the Anglophone regions of Cameroon. The problem is in Yaoundé. The problem is at the level of the presidency. We have a president who has absolutely no political will to solve that problem. And he's the root cause of the problem, because the problem started, the way we know it today, started by the fact that there is a clear perception of marginalization in the Anglophone regions of Cameroon. And this marginalization is the handiwork of the president in place. So the only way to bring a lasting solution for Cameroon to remain as one country is to get rid of the person who created this, the problem in the first place.
Well, somebody asked me to ask you that you are running as an Anglophone Cameroonian or a Cameroonian who happens to speak English, although you speak French as well. How do you intend canvassing for votes for people in the English-speaking areas to vote for you, particularly when they can't even register to become prospective voters to vote for you due to the ongoing crisis in the regions?
Well, I think you have to understand that before the crisis started, elections have been holding in those two parts of the country and that the register was open. In 2013, there was an election. It's a very difficult situation for those living in the southwest and northwest regions of Cameroon today, because it's clear that those who were not registered at a certain time, especially when the violence erupted, have a lot of difficulties to get registered. We're talking to the Electoral Commission at this time and to government on measures that can be taken to avoid double marginalization, that people are in violence because of marginalization and they're marginalized a second time because they're unable to vote. I'm doing everything possible to make this happen, to make sure that these people can vote wherever they find themselves today. Most of them are internally displaced, be they official internally displaced or unofficial, those living with families and friends. So we're looking forward at that. But you have to understand that the electoral register was opened in 2012, and that was a bit before violence erupted. So one of the main concerns we have today, first of all, is to make sure that those who are already registered get to vote. And a secondary concern is to look at ways and means to put in place a mechanism that can allow those who were unable to register because of the violence to have some special, I would say, dispositions taken outside of the law.
So talking about this election, some of your critics are saying you keep on meeting Francophones, both in Cameroon and even here in the diaspora since you've been here, and that you've taken the Anglophones for granted, and that they shouldn't even vote for you because they might not even be able to vote due to the ongoing crisis. The elections in the English-speaking areas could be suspect, and you are aware of that. So they're saying, why should Cameroonians who speak English vote for you when you intend or you're spending all your capital literally in the Francophone areas?
Well, I don't know on what basis you're saying that, because
these are your critics, by the way.
Sure. Well, mm-hmm. I don't know why those critics want to use that excuse to give another mandate to Mr. Biya, who is 86 today, and so will have a 90-year-old president. People disguise in various forms to hold a whole population hostage. And many disguise as critics of the regime, whereas what they're doing is to support that regime. The only way Mr. Biya can remain in power is if he makes sure that at least those two regions do not vote. And Mr. Biya knows this. So he's doing everything possible to make sure that the situation is out of control. And unfortunately, people are falling into that trap. And so people are playing his own game without even being paid for it. So you can either sit there, watch the country burn. You can sit there, watch all our mothers being killed as it's being done today. Or you can take up your courage and say, okay, this thing must stop. I have two ways to make it stop. You can either take, as I said, the bullet or the ballot. I am on the side of the ballot. I am convinced that today we must stand up as one people, not as Anglophones, not as Francophones, but as Cameroonians, as one people.
But realistically, do you even have chances?
Let me go to the end to reclaim our sovereignty, which we lost about 40 years ago, to reclaim our nation.
What sovereignty are you talking about?
Because our country today is no longer controlled by those who own the country, by Cameroonians. It's controlled by one clique they have absolutely nothing in common with us, and they don't care about our future. And that is why it is important for us. We've been fighting for 28 years to make sure that 2018 comes, to make sure that we can, without using bullets, reclaim our nation.
And just when we are getting there,
some people have, whether they are on the regime's agenda or they are innocently playing that game, one or the other. The result is that they're trying to make people believe, just as your next question will do, they're trying to make people believe that, first of all, it cannot happen, and secondly, we're just wasting our time.
Before you go on in the litany of things that you're saying, mm-hmm. polls show that Paul Biya remains resolute and he is confident.
There is absolutely has been no opinion poll.
Well, from what I have seen so far, he stands a chance of winning.
There has been.
And let me finish.
Okay.
Before you come in, mm-hmm. the critics are saying that there is no way Paul Biya is going to allow you to win an election in Cameroon. And as one of your aides was telling me, 20 years ago, John Fruindi, you know, won the election, but he did not become president of Cameroon. What makes you special? What makes you think you can defeat him at his own game, if I may put it that way?
Okay, first of all, maybe just to enlighten you, there's been no opinion poll because opinion polls are strictly regulated, and I can say, to use the right word, are banned in Cameroon. So there's been no opinion poll.
Well, I have seen five of them.
If you've seen any poll, that means it's information anybody tried to put out, and I think I'll start making my own polls too, so that you...
Well, that is your choice.
What I'm telling you is that you cannot conduct an opinion poll on a legal basis in Cameroon, and that already distorts anything you want to do on polling, because the law doesn't provide for such. So there has been no opinion poll in Cameroon so far, I would say for the past 2 years. So you have to be comfortable with that. I'm not saying it's a good thing. I am against it because I would like such opinion polls to exist. There have been some Ukrainian papers who've come out with a poll, and one other one from Lithuania that came out with another poll. I don't know since when Cameroon is of interest to those countries, but anyway, that is what happened, and people tend to believe in what anybody says nowadays. That's the drama of our fourth industrial revolution. But what I want to tell you is that exactly the same way people are ready to influence your mind or your thought process that polls exist in Cameroon, whereas none was holding, it's exactly the same tools that will be used that didn't exist 20 years ago, as you rightfully said it, to make sure that we enforce the results of the election that come up. What happened in Gabon a couple of months ago was not possible 10 years ago. It is because today... information circulates. 20 years ago, nobody even knew in the rest of the world that an election was going on in Cameroon. And today, everybody knows what is going on. So we will use all the tools at our disposal to make sure that the results are known. And as to how those results get enforced, that is part of a strategy that you would permit me, I would not want to disclose
I'm going to hold you to that after the elections on October 9th. Let me ask you this question.
Just before you get into your question, I'm happy of your optimism that you finally, after our long debates before we got into the studio, understand that we'll win. Otherwise, you will not hold me to that.
Well, I'm going to hold you to it. Now, in 1954, mm-hmm. Ambazonians or the Cameroonians from the English-speaking side representatives walked away from Nigeria's House of Assembly saying that they were mistreated. Mm-hmm. Now, some people are saying, as a parliamentarian or a member of parliament, a lawmaker in Cameroon, why are the English speakers not walking away to make a statement? Well, their words, not mine.
Yeah, sure. Well, in 1954, there was a colony or a trust territory. You can use any word you want. There was British interests ruling over a territory called Nigeria, Southern Cameroons, and Northern Cameroons. Okay? And that was a whole different epoch. It has nothing to do with what is happening today. But the most important point is that we cannot in our bedrooms or in our parlors start, I would call it a revolution, and believe that everybody must follow suit on what you have started. I am part of the Social Democratic Front with an agenda to liberate all of Cameroon, including the Northwest and Southwest. But guess what? The Northwest and Southwest voted predominantly for the regime in place in Yaoundé. I never held someone hostage for that. I accepted those results, the party accepted those results, and we moved on. And those people in parliament, the majority of those from the English-speaking part, basically all except one MP from the Southwest, comes from the ruling party. So the people voted these people in. Whether we like it or not, with or without election rigging, there is no smoke without fire. There was a support for those politicians. So today you are asking me to move out of parliament. That is not my agenda. My agenda is to change Cameroon in parliament. And the agenda of all those of the SDF is to change Cameroon in parliament. So we believe that we are in the place we're supposed to be.
Hold your thought. We'll come back. Joseph Ossi is the presidential candidate. Joshua Ossi is the presidential candidate for the Cameroonian Main Opposition Social Democratic Front, SDF. He joins me here in Washington, D.C. The Sierra Leonean Anti-Corruption Commission has accused former Vice President Victor Faure and former Mines Minister Mikhailu Mansere of corruption. Both men were briefly arrested and released on bail Thursday. The arrest came after a recent report alleged egregious corruption under former President Ernest Bai Koroma's administration, including state property theft and the award of contract to allies of the former president. But in a rebuttal, the former president sharply denied the accusations as false. For more about the fight against corruption, I reach Mohamed Radu Soare, the Sierra Leonean Information Minister in the capital of Freetown.
Let me confirm that indeed the former Vice President of the Republic, Mr. Victor Bokari Faure, and the then Mines and Mineral Resources Minister, Mr. Mikhailu Mansere, who also doubled at the time as Vice Chairman of the APC, have been indicted by the Anti-Corruption Commission to answer to various allegations against them relating to last year's bungled up hajj.
Some people are suggesting that this is a calculated attempt by the government to tarnish the hard-earned reputation and the good works of the former administration just to make them unpopular.
Well, as a matter of fact, this action has been very, very widely acclaimed. Everybody in Sierra Leone is aware that we had a messed up hajj last year, where scholarships intended for deserving pilgrims were sold off, where visas were issued to the wrong persons, where monies were foolish off people, and the entire hajj became a nightmare. Many of those who were meant to have performed last year's hajj, some of them have died without getting justice. We believe that is despicable and must not allow public officials to get away with murder. This is a new day, and therefore, we have to let public officials account for their actions. Because democracy is not just about the holding of periodic elections, it also has other hallmarks, including democratic accountability. Public officials should account for the sins of yesteryear so that serves as a loud, clear, and palpable signal for the rest of us who are currently in government to know that being in leadership does not bestow everything on you to run the state like a private banana farm.
Well, the recent document that was released by the government has shown that some amount of corruption was done during the previous administration. However, the former president, Ernest Bai Koroma, has rejected the accusations and said that they did work for the people of Sierra Leone and that these allegations are false. Some are suggesting that the allegations being made in the handover notes were made just targeting the former president and those who worked hard and tirelessly for the administration. How do you respond to such criticisms that this is all made up just to tarnish the reputation of the former president and his government?
First, we note that President Bio has been in government before. Remember, he led our country to return to democratic civilian rule in 1996. So he clearly recognizes and appreciates contributions of past leaders. But that is not to say because they have been in leadership, everything was hunky-dory. We had a leadership that ran this country to the ground. We inherited an external debt of, for example, $1.6 billion, massive domestic debt, to an extent that in the last 2 years, following our takeover of government in April, we only had the opportunity to pay salaries while we took over without resort to bank lending and whatever. For example, the current transition team report has uncovered massive graft, massive looting of state resources on such an egregious scale that any responsible government cannot turn the other eye while it's preside over this kind of thing without calling perpetrators to book. This is not a witch hunt. This is only intended to draw a line under impunity. 57 years of nationhood, we still have to resort to other countries to lend vehicles to support our inauguration activities in 2007, 2012, and most recently. It is for those reasons that President Bill has enjoined all of us to be that group of men and women
who helped save this country from imminent collapse. In fact, in our guess to fight corruption, we do not see tribe, we do not see color, we only see forest and not trees.
Some are saying that the APC or the former ruling party still has supporters. So by going after them legally, basically could create possible tension and instability. How will the government resolve this concern?
Well, that is the blackmail. They want to blackmail this country and hold it to ransom. We are saying democratic accountability is part of the trail that keeps the engine of a sound and fledgling democracy working. We call on every Soil Union to see this as an opportunity to sanitize our country and to ensure that we put it on the right trajectory for takeoff in the best interest of all Soil Unions. I have always said, when public officials loot this country with reckless abandon, they do not do so for their tribes, they do not do so for their political parties, they do it to feather their own nest. So we want to be able to claw back those looted resources using existing democratic channels to ensure that we use these resources for the much needed development of our country. It is not a witch hunt. President Bio will not go down that path. He has committed to running this country in the best interest of Soil Union, and that is what we will do. He's known for matching his every word with his every action.
Mohammed Rado Sware is the Soil Union Information Minister. He spoke with me from Freetown. Guinean ruling New Patriotic Party, NPP, is holding its National Delegates Conference to choose new leaders for the group for the next 4 years. The conference is currently underway at the Koforidua Technical University in the country's eastern region. About 600 delegates will elect over 14 members seeking to become executives of the NPP. Officials say they are satisfied with the final list of aspirants for each position, having met the qualification criteria established by the National Executive Committee of the party. For more about the delegates conference, Richard Ahiagba, a prominent member of the NPP in North America and a candidate seeking to become the next general secretary for the ruling party, expresses his views.
We're very confident. We're confident because our party has been going through some kind of urgent need for renewal. The experience, the feeling in our party appears to be calling for change. What we have seen in the past 2 years, or nearly 2 years now since we came to power, our party grassroots felt abandoned. They have felt is neglected because much of the opportunity that came with being in power, they have not felt it. If you go around here today and ask anybody about what possibilities they have had since the party came to power, they will tell you none. The truth of the matter is that NPP as a political party, we have proven time and time again that we are capable. We are a competent group of people who can handle the economy of our country. But time and time again, we have also demonstrated that we lack what it takes to be able to take care of our own people.
Richard, you have a competent opponent in John Bwedu, who is the acting secretary general. Some people are saying to me that he is well known. He's been with the party for a long time, just like yourself, but he has been the face of the party for some time now. They said you are a diasporan, although you work for the party, but John Bwedu is a household commodity. Are you confident that you would defeat him based on your campaign so far?
That is just talk. The truth of the matter, which we have obtained from our delegates, talking to them one-on-one, engaging them, what we have picked up is not whether or not somebody is known. Truly, what our delegates are focused on is this, that our party needs to be administered in a particular way. It's not being administered that way. What they are looking for is someone who can do the job, not somebody who appears to be in a position, occupying a position for the sake of it, but somebody who can come in and pick up the party for where we are, to organize it in a way that we are able to win beyond 2 terms. And the only way you can do that, the only way you can win beyond 2 terms with NPP is making sure that our grassroots is mobilized, is engaged, and attended to. That's what we are offering. That's what we are capable of doing. That's what the grassroots is looking for.
I understand some delegates who came all across the country have not been given proper accommodation. They've even complained about the choice of Koforidua. Granted, they gave you the mandate to be their secretary general. What will you do about this the next time?
You know, the less said about that, the better. The truth of the matter is that the conditions and the situation in which our people have had to survive last night and possibly tonight is very regrettable, to say the least. Nothing like that will happen again. We have the capacity to organize a better event. To begin with, the event was organized in the rainy season. That is one flag that we shouldn't have done that. But then to go forward and put people in a situation, the conditions under which we put them, that is one reason they should go out there and vote for someone, not only who is competent, not only who is able to administer the party properly, but somebody who is able to bring human feeling to the administration of the party and the handling of party people and party affairs. That is the reason we are confident today that change is going to come. We cannot continue to treat our own people this way, and we are determined to make sure that by hook or crook today, by democratic, we'll bring change and make sure that we will never put our party delegates in these commissions anymore. It is regrettable, and we pray that none of the delegates will suffer any harm as a result of this, but all of them will be in good health to be able to prosecute the business that we are here to do for our party.
Richard Ahiagba is a candidate seeking to become the next general secretary for the Ghanaian ruling party. He spoke with me from Koforidua. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, the Malawi Electoral Commission says it would continue to dialogue with all political parties, civil society groups, and other stakeholders to keep them informed about plans for next year's general election. The move, the electoral body says, forms part of the effort to ensure transparency in the polling process. The announcement came as the Electoral Commission compiles a voter list to be used for the election. Meanwhile, for the first time in the country's burgeoning democracy, the Malawian government will fully fund the activities of the Electoral Commission to organize the polls. For more about preparations ahead of next year's vote, I read Dr. Jane Ansah, chairperson for the Malawi Electoral Commission.
In terms of government support, it's 100%. And we are able to prepare. You see, because in preparation, you need money. When money is not there, you cannot talk of much of preparation. So right now, voter registration is in progress, and it is progressing well. It started on 26th June, and it's going to be in 8 phases. We will end on November 9th.
Well, I understand for the first time in the country's history, the country will finance all aspects of the electoral process. How significant is this?
This is very significant that the government has given us 100% support. They have given us all the money for our budget that we submitted. This is significant because before, government would give 60% and the development partners 40%. And most of the time, you know, the funding will come in late. You know, it's a ripple effect. If money comes in late, then the purchases, the procurement is also delayed, and that affects the polling. So the government this year has gone flat out to give us 100%.
Does that mean that the Electoral Commission will be adequately prepared logistically to organize these elections next year?
Yes, we will be adequately prepared. However, there are still, you know, areas where we need support, and the development partners have come up, and they have also, through the basket fund, they are giving us support in areas where we could have hiccups.
Madam Chairperson, talk to me about measures you have implemented to ensure next year's tripartite elections are free, fair, transparent, and credible, because you are aware that previous elections organized by the Electoral Commission have been accused of bias in one way or the other. What measures are you putting in place to ensure transparency and credibility of next year's elections?
Yes. The Malawi Electoral Commission has been accused of bias. I believe because there were certain areas that were not transparent. We have implemented administrative reforms which will enhance transparency. We have tested these administrative reforms during our by-election, and they have worked well, and the results were received, and the stakeholders accepted them as credible. What we have done is that for the first time in Malawi, we have adopted biometric voter registration system. This will produce credible voters' roll, which is very, very important for elections. And the administrative reforms that we have put in place, they are to do with a counting of ballots, that as soon as polling comes to an end, the ballots are opened in the presence of monitors and counted. As soon as the counting is over, the recording on the result sheet will be done in figures as well as in words. So if it is 300 votes, it will be 300 in figures and 300 in words. This will ensure that no one will tamper with the figures. Like if there's 10 votes, someone cannot add a zero to make 100. And after that, all monitors will sign to verify that is the outcome of the results. And then the result sheet will be pasted at the polling center, and each monitor will have a copy of the result sheet that they will go away with. From there, we have introduced tallying at the constituency level. So at the constituency level, that's where all the figures will be tallied, and then the winners will be known. We have introduced transportation of election materials. We have divided them into two. They are sensitive materials and non-sensitive materials. And they are going to be delivered at the polling station 4 days before and 2 days before.
Dr. Jane Ansah is the chairperson for the Malawi Electoral Commission. She spoke with me from the capital, Lilongwe. Tulani Maseko, a human rights activist, has filed a court petition challenging King Nswati's decision to change the name of the Kingdom of Swaziland to its new official name, Eswatini. Maseko says the king failed to widely consult the population as stipulated in the constitution, which he says enables citizens to protect the southern African kingdom. King Nswati announced the name change in April at the celebrations to mark the 50th anniversary of the independence of Swaziland from Britain. Officials are yet to respond to the court petition, but supporters of the government have dismissed it as a mere publicity stunt. For more about the petition, I read Tulani Maseko in Bunya, in Eswatini.
In 2005, Swaziland adopted the constitution, and section 1 says this is the kingdom of Swaziland, and it says we are a democratic country. So I thought about the way that the king announced the name of the country without consultation with the people. I found that to be not within the provision of the constitution.
Well, but there's an understanding that the king and his mother are the only two people in the kingdom of Eswatini at this present moment who are above the constitution, so he is not shackled by the trappings or the stipulations in the constitution. How do you react to that?
Reading of the constitution, section 2 says the king and Ingwenyama and all citizens of Swaziland have a right to protect and defend the constitution. And the section 4, which says that, you know, all that the king does, he do within the parameters of the constitution. So there is, I think, a debate around whether indeed it is true that the king is above the law in the country, given that we have a supreme law in Swaziland. I felt that the court has got to test to what extent they can go about performing its function in the presence of the written constitution, which says it is the supreme law of the land.
But is the judiciary independent enough to possibly rule against the monarchy?
Of course, it is a given. Members of the judiciary appointed by the JSC, and members of the JSC, the Judicial Service Commission, are themselves appointed by the king. So there's a perception that the courts may not be independent. given the way that they are appointed. But if one reads the constitution, it says the court must be independent. So this is not only a test to the extent to which we respect the constitution, but it is a test on the very independence of the court and to what extent the king is prepared to give effect to the findings of the court if the court would find that the renaming of the country was not in line with the constitution. I am aware of those sentiments, but I felt that as someone believes in the rule of law, and once you have a document that calls itself a supreme law, it must be the guiding, you know, principle on the corner of state power.
Well, Tulani, are you safe knowing how supporters of the king are so resolute in their unflinching support for him? Because some people have expressed concern that this challenge could potentially be dangerous for you.
Well, all my life I've been living in danger, and if this should make any difference, I'm prepared to stand up to the challenge, and if it becomes unbearable, I will look at what options are available for me to protect myself. But at the moment, I don't feel intimidated. I don't feel under threat. I don't feel under pressure. I'll wait to see how the governor, the king, reacts. This is just a legal process, and I think everybody who believes in the law must accept that every citizen of this country has the right to approach the court where they feel that they've been undermined or their rights have been violated. So I'm acting in the public interest, actually, to ensure that whoever commands public authority acts within the parameters of the law. So what they do about it, I'll wait and see how they react.
Some supporters of the king are calling you a terrorist using the legal process as a cover because you are being supported by pro-democracy activists who have been banned or described as terrorists by the government, and that this is yet another move to create disaffection and create disunity in the kingdom. Your response to that?
Well, I think then it means they must define for me what they understand to be a terrorist. We are not carrying any guns. We are not terrorizing people. We are not acting in any violent manner. All that you are saying is that we can be a better society if everybody respects the law. And the fact that, you know, the king merely announced this, you know, decision without consulting the people is a fundamental issue in Swaziland. And, you know, the system in this country has always portrayed itself as one that believes in consultations, even if the window dress in doing so. This time, there was no attempt whatsoever on their behalf to pretend to be consulting the people whether or not the name of the country must be changed. That's one thing. The second thing, we don't know what the implications of this name change are. But the most fear that we are actually considering is that the king may declare anything as it deems fit without consulting the people, yet we claim to be a democracy. So I'm not concerned about the king's supporters or even king himself thinking that you are terrorists. We're not terrorists. We're not carrying guns. We're not fighting anybody. We're using the court, his court and the law. He must act within the parameters of the law that he himself promulgated.
Tulani Maseko is a human rights activist in the Kingdom of Eswatini. He spoke with me from Bunia. Before we go to music, the Cameroonian main opposition Social Democratic Front has chosen Joshua Ossie as the candidate for the upcoming presidential election. We spoke with him earlier, but he's still with me here. So, Joshua, before we go to the music, the elections are coming on October 9th, the presidential election. How credible will this be, and how acceptable will this be for the people of Cameroon?
Well, just a correction. The election hasn't been summoned up yet. And so the date is, as far as I know, not yet set.
But somebody, the constitutional lawyer, told me that October 9th cannot be changed, they said, per the constitution.
Well, that's one of the problems we have when lawyers say that you cannot change the fact that an election needs to hold this year, that period, but there is a window of about 20 days in which it can be held.
As you mean, it comes on October 9th as stipulated. Mm-hmm. How credible will it be?
Well, the stipulation will be October 14th and not 9th because it has to be on a Sunday. Anyway, that notwithstanding, I don't think that we're running credible elections in Africa, but the SDF has done a lot since 1990.
Well, let me make a correction. There have been credible elections in Africa.
To make sure, when I say credible elections, it means elections where nobody, no party whatsoever is in contestation with the results or with the process and so on. So it's very difficult to get there. You don't get there overnight. What I'm saying is that we have been working very hard to get acceptable elections, elections that can bring about democratic change. And I think that we've got to the point where if the political parties in opposition, the civil society and voters, that is the citizens, come out and want to effect change on the day of election, it is possible to do so today in many African countries. We shouldn't be sitting down and believe that someone will come down from heaven or will come down from Europe to try to change our countries, or believe that you can only change these countries through weapons. We can do it with the ballot, and I insist on it. And I can tell you that lots of Cameroonians have given their lives for us to get to that point. And so it's a very precious moment in the life of Cameroon, and people have to believe in what has been done so far. Let them not believe that because they did nothing, every other person just folded their hands and slept down there. No, people were working. You know, we've gone a very, very, very long road. I was just listening to what is going on in Malawi. In Malawi, they claim to be getting to credible elections because, from what I got in the interview on this show, because they have a biometric register. That is something the SDF was fighting from since 1990, and we finally got it in 2012. And this will be the first election to be held with a biometric register, which means a lot.
What are you going to do with some of your supporters? Because somebody told me this, that some of your supporters have been affected by this ongoing crisis. They are in camps in neighboring countries. How are you going to get them to vote for you?
Well, I told you, I just told you recently, maybe you didn't follow, that one of the things we're working on right now is to make sure that all these people vote, because it's not of their own choice that
they are displaced. How will they vote? Vote outside the country or come back and vote?
You're interviewing the person who wants that to happen. You're not interviewing the person who has executive orders to make that happen. So that will be his. What we're doing right now is to do everything possible for them to vote. And we use the example of what happened in Borno State during the recent presidential election in Nigeria, where the displaced of the Boko Haram crisis were allowed to vote. And we're saying the same mechanism can happen in Cameroon, whereby the people who were registered in the who are registered in the areas where there is unrest right now, where there is violence, should be allowed to vote wherever they find themselves, just like the army is allowed to vote in the present law. But that will need an executive order, and I'm not qualified to sign that executive order. So all I can do is to push and to put the idea on the table, you'll be surprised to hear that the government was very favorable to this argumentation, because the point we put on the table is that these people have fled violence, violence that occurred because of their marginalization, fundamentally because of the marginalization of the Anglophones in Cameroon. And now that they have fled violence, they are suffering a second marginalization in that they're not allowed to choose who will lead the country for the next 7 years. So everything has to be done to make sure that we can look at ways and means, put in place a mechanism for them to be allowed to vote. And now I'm calling on all of those who are in places where they can register to go and register massively before the elections are summoned. Because once the elections are summoned, that's the law, the registration stops. Immediately they are summoned, at that point in time, it stops. So wherever they find themselves, even if they were registered somewhere else before, they can register, and they tell Elecam they're simply changing their point of registration. Their vote will count. A vote counts not where you live. A vote counts not where you vote. A vote counts because you're a citizen and you want that country to change. So people can go out there massively and register. And for those who are unable to register because they find themselves trapped in between the state violence and the other violence, those people, we're trying to do everything possible to make sure that if they were registered at one time before this, that on the day of the election, dispositions will be taken for them to be allowed to vote.
The government has always stated that it has not been sponsoring any violence. You just mentioned that it's state violence. Do you have proof? And can you disprove the government's claim that it is not
in any way doing anything of what you just said?
Well, the government has made it abundantly clear that the violence that is attributed to it is the individual responsibility of some members of the armed forces who did it without command from above, which means in normal or simple English that there has been violence perpetrated by the army. That has happened. And there's violence on both sides of the divide. What we're living today in Cameroon is that two extremist positions exist. You have the extremists on the one side who want secession and who are using violence to get there, and you have the extremists on the other side who come from the government and who do not want to lose their positions of privilege and the looting of the country and have sent in troops to be extremely violent, to break away the other or to smash the other extremists. And you have the large majority of the population suffering in the middle. And I think we never talk about them. But the reality is that those people being killed, most of them didn't ask to be killed. Those villages being burned down, most of them didn't ask to be in this conflict. And so it is very important to understand that in as much as there is evidence of government violence, there is evidence of military violence, there is violence too on the other side. And I think we've come to the point where, and that is why a couple of weeks ago, we were very clear about the position where we're calling for a ceasefire, so that even if you need any part of the divide to start talking around the table, you first of all need to halt the violence.
Let me ask you this. Some of those alleged separatists, so-called as the government calls them, have accused you of being a sellout. Do you think you have the crossover appeal, if elections were summoned today, to have both the Anglophones and the Francophones voting for you in your pursuit of becoming the next president of Cameroon?
Well, I think it is the only chance we have if we want to keep the country together after this election. There is no other. There is absolutely no other chance. We need to use this election to build that bridge. That bridge has been destroyed from both ends. Okay, we need to be clear about that. It has been destroyed by both ends. It has been destroyed by both ends because of 50 years of bad governance. Because of 50 years of bad governance that has degenerated into marginalization, that has gone as far as making it such that Cameroonian citizens believe that they're better off restoring the colonial boundaries of southern Cameroon. So let me call it as it is, and for that reason, it means that the bound of trust between those governing and those being governed no longer exists, and the only way to do that is to change the leadership in Yaoundé, and the only way to do it in a way that these people can, how can I say, can build up the trust again so that we can come to talking terms, is that somebody is elected who understands the problem, who is in talking terms with both sides of the extreme divide, talking terms with the extremists in government because I'm a member of parliament, on talking terms with the extremists who are for restoration because I come from that area. I can tell you my father's house was burned by troops just last week in the village. So I have about 6 family members who have lost their lives in that battle. So I am hard hit. I am in the middle of it. It's not something I say with pride because I say that with a bleeding heart. But it is in the interest of every party who believes that what is happening in Cameroon, even the violence that is happening in Cameroon, should stop, because what we're doing or what we want is a better Cameroon for our kids. It's in the interest of all these people to make sure that we use this election to put in place a leadership that is open to inclusiveness and that is open and that understands the problems of Cameroonians. Because the biggest problem we have and the biggest challenge, which is not limited to the Southwest and Northwest, which is general, is that we have a leadership in place that is everything except Cameroonian. They don't understand the problems of Cameroonians. They don't live with Cameroonians. Yes.
Before we leave, some of your critics are saying parliamentarians particularly those English-speaking parliamentarians, have not been forceful enough in Parliament to press home the demand for a realization that they are being marginalized and that the government has yet to put in structures to address their concerns. What do you say to such critics?
Well, I am not an English-speaking parliamentarian, and there's nothing like an English-speaking parliamentarian. In Cameroon, when you're a member of parliament, you represent the entire nation in parliament. There are people of English-speaking extraction who are in parliament, and there is no English-speaking parliamentary caucus in the parliament in Cameroon. That doesn't exist because by definition and constitutionally, Cameroon is a bilingual country. There is a caucus of members of parliament who come from the English part of Cameroon, and this caucus is being managed by the ruling party. And then there is a political party, and there is a big difference with that. There is a political party which is not a group of English-speaking parliamentarians. There is an opposition caucus in parliament, which is the SDF parliamentary group in parliament, led by Honorable Banazem. And this group has been extremely vocal. And the nightmare of the Yaounde regime is the SDF parliamentary group. So if you tell me that we haven't done our job, then either you don't follow up what is going on in Cameroon, I mean those critics telling you that, or then they have another agenda.
Joshua Osi is the presidential candidate for the Cameroonian main opposition Social Democratic Front. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Saleh, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Justin Thwaite, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, when one's goat gets missing, the aroma of a neighbor's soup gets suspicious. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Trafficking in persons or modern slavery is a crime that involves the exploitation of a human being for the purposes of compelled labor or a commercial sex act through the use of force, fraud, or coercion, or the use of a child in the commercial sex industry. It also includes the unlawful recruitment and use of child soldiers. It is a heinous crime, and it is global in nature. No country is immune. Today, some 25 million people around the world are victims of human trafficking. Every year, the United States Department of State issues its annual Trafficking in Persons, or TIP, report, which evaluates the anti-trafficking efforts of 187 countries and territories, including the United States. The TIP report places countries on one of four tiers, depending on each government's efforts to prosecute traffickers, protect victims, and prevent the crime. Tier 1 is for countries that are meeting the minimum standards. Tier 2 countries have not met the minimum standards but are making significant efforts to do so. Tier 2 watch list is for countries that are making significant efforts but deserve closer scrutiny. Finally, Tier 3 is for countries that have not met the minimum standards and are not making significant efforts to do so. In the 2018 report, 29 countries were upgraded while 20 earned downgrades. And there were also positive developments across entire regions, as Secretary of State Mike Pompeo at the report's launch ceremony on June 28th.
The 48 African countries included in the report, 14 received upgrades, meaning we observed a strong trend of increased efforts to improve their overall response. Despite significant security threats, migration challenges, other financial constraints, and other obstacles, the region improved significantly.
Human trafficking deprives millions worldwide of their dignity and freedom. It undermines national security, distorts markets, and enriches transnational criminals and terrorists. And it is an affront to the universal values we as Americans hold dear, said Secretary of State Pompeo. The United States remains a committed leader in combating this global threat. President Trump has made ending human trafficking a top priority for the administration and dedicated the government's full resources to fighting this crime.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.